Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I'm Monique Anton, your host, and I have with me on the show today, Mr. Alan Hess. How are you, Alan?
I am fine, Monique. Good to be here.
Good to have you. So Alan Hess is an architect, a historian, a lecturer, and an author of 21 books on modernism and urbanism. And your latest book on Frank Lloyd Wright, you're talking about natural architecture and organic architecture. Can you share with us a little bit about your new book that just is coming out?
Well, Frank Lloyd Wright, of course, was way ahead of his time in so many ways, and particularly going back over 100 years. He was interested in nature, in issues of sustainability, of working with nature, passive solar design, passive ventilation, all of those things, which, of course, are very important today. So yes, there are so many lessons that we can still learn from Frank Lloyd Wright. In addition, of course, his buildings are absolutely beautiful. They are restful, beautiful, harmonious. They fit in with their site. They're innovative. They're looking to the future. I mean, they're all those things as well. But in particular, Wright never ceases to have new things to tell us.
Yes.
And that's what this book in particular is about, how he used nature as an inspiration, but also working with nature to create his great designs. In many ways, he was one of the early masters of modern architecture, defining modern architecture, and it was nature that set him apart from the other modern masters.
Yes. I love how you've covered him in different ways. You've talked about his modern homes. You've talked about his prairie homes. So everyone listening, you can go on Amazon and see all of Alan Hess's work on Frank Lloyd Wright. But I like to call you the Googie Master because I learned about Googie through you. And this was not only through your two books, but through your posts on social media and all of your lectures that you've given. For those people listening, can you give us a little micro lecture of Googie?
Sure. Googie is a name. It is the name comes from a restaurant in Hollywood on the Sunset Strip named Googie's, and it was designed by John Lautner. Now, for those of you who know, John Lautner was one of Frank Lloyd Wright's primary associates and students. So there's a direct connection there between Frank Lloyd Wright and Googie. But what Googie was about after World War II, America is becoming prosperous again. The suburbs are being built. Soldiers are coming home from war and they want to get back to peace and prosperity, and they want a house in the suburbs with a backyard, and they want to raise families. And all of these things created a building boom throughout America, but particularly in California. California being the kind of the leader, the innovator of many of these post-war architectural innovations. And of course, the houses that you know so well, Monique, are part of that. Mid-century modern houses, whether they're individual custom homes or if they're the tract homes of Joseph Eichler, whichever. Yes. But the thing was, these people, these veterans coming back, they didn't just want a house. They wanted a school for their children. They wanted parks. They wanted a shopping center. They wanted a coffee shop. They wanted a shopping center, you know, all of these things. They wanted an entire city, which was modern. Right. And Doogie was part of that. It, as I said, it was originally, the name came from a coffee shop on the Sunset Strip. And it was designed for the automobile. As you drove down the Sunset Strip at 30 or 40 miles an hour, Googie buildings had to stand out. They had to be of a scale, a size, but usually they were fairly small buildings. So how did you do that? You did it with a roof line that swooped up, zigzagged. And the purpose of that, again, was to give this small building an identity that would draw your attention. And they used modern architecture. I mean, those swoops and zigzags, those are all modern engineering ideas. The folded plate roof is the zigzag, or cantilevers, different things of that sort. So that is what made Googie modern. And of course, it was for the modern family. It was for the modern person driving down in their brand new car that they just picked up at the Googie style dealership down the road. And they were stopping for a hamburger or, you know, tuna melt or whatever. So a whole series of roadside coffee shops developed, and they used the Googie style, this ultra modern style, because that's what appealed to people at that time. And what's important, you know, as I said, there's such a wide variety of great mid-century modern architecture. And we think of the beautiful custom homes of Richard Neutra, for example, or John Lautner. Well, not everybody could afford a big, beautiful custom home up in the Hollywood Hills looking out over the city. But for the price of a hamburger and a piece of pie, the average person at a Googie coffee shop could participate in that modern life, because the modern materials, steel, glass, terrazzo, plastics, were all part of the composition of these buildings. And the design was modern as any residence of that time was as well. So that to me is what is most important about Googie. It brought modernism to everyday life as you're going around, and again, you know, it could be libraries, it could be shopping centers, certainly coffee shops. All of these things where people spent their daily life were modern. So
love that. And you have, I love that. And you have two, that was amazing, by the way. I'm going to show that to anyone interested in Googie. And you have the two books on Googie with you, I believe, right? We're going to hold those up. One is Googie Modern that you can get on Amazon. And the other one is, there it is, Googie Modern.
This is awesome. Book of the architectural drawings of one of the prominent Googie architects, Armé Davis Newlove, who were responsible, for those of you in Southern California, Pans, Bob's Big Boys, Ships, many of those well-known coffee shops were by Armé and Davis. And then this is it's almost 20 years old now, a history of Googie and its where it came from and how it relates to residential architecture, urban architecture, automobile design of the time. Googie was, a pan-cultural event. You see it in all forms of architecture and design, household products, etc.
Yes, that's amazing that you have those books. You also have, we're going to skip over now to Oscar Niemeyer. And you have a couple books about him as well and his work and beautiful visuals. And I wanted to share with our listeners a little bit about your expertise about him as well, if you can share with us.
Sure. Oscar Niemeyer, Brazilian, of course, He worked with Le Corbusier in the 1930s. Le Corbusier was hired to design a high-rise government building in Rio de Janeiro, which was then the capital of Brazil. It was for the Ministry of Education. And so he collected around him several of the best young architects and landscape architects in Brazil at that time. Because Brazil is a fascinating country. I've had an opportunity to live there for periods of time. And it's, you know, a huge country. It's the largest country in South America. And it has its own particular character as well. And it is in the middle of not only the Amazon and the natural resources of the Amazon, but also the high plains, what they call the Planalto, as well. Incredible variety of plants. It's near the, it's on the equator, of course, so it's very lush in many parts of the country. And so more than perhaps any other country, other than maybe Mexico in South America and Central America, Brazil had this defining character. And Oscar Niemeyer, who was born in Rio de Janeiro, really embodied that character. And it's everything that you might think of having to do with Brazil, carnival and samba, the music, but also the literature and the architecture as well. Incredibly rich culture in Brazil. Oscar Niemeyer was able to put all of these elements together into a very unique architectural expression. As I said, he started early on in his career. He worked with Le Corbusier on this international style office building, high-rise office building in the center of Rio de Janeiro. It's a beautiful building, really extraordinary. And it's very Corbusian for that time. It's a flat roof, rectilinear slab rising into the sky, and then lower elements at the base. Interestingly, Niemeyer, later in his career, after he had this experience, went in a different direction. He didn't, for the most part, do right angles and flat roofs and geometric forms. He was Brazilian. And when you think of the, not only the music, you know, samba, the rhythms, you think of the plants of the Amazon as well. These beautiful, organic, lush, curvilinear forms. That's Brazilian. And Oscar Niemeyer took those Brazilian forms and put them into architecture. So you'll find his buildings, for the most part, are curved, the curvilinear. They're amoeba shapes. They're three-dimensional conch shell sorts of things, all going back to nature, which is, again, what was all around anybody in Brazil. So it fit, but it was very different than what his master Le Corbusier had been doing. It's interesting just in the history of modern architecture to realize that a little bit later in his career, Le Corbusier also started to explore curvilinear forms. You think of the chapel at Ronchamp, for example. So it could be a case of where the master was learning from the student.
From the student.
Yeah. And I did have an opportunity to meet Oscar Niemeyer in the early 90s at his office right on Copacabana a beach in Rio de Janeiro. Top floor of about, I don't know, eighth floor, looking out over the ocean and the beach, and absolutely, you know, gorgeous. And he through an interpreter told me about his architecture, did some drawings, which actually I have framed here on my wall, as he was talking about what was important to him as architecture, not only nature, but also what did you see And where was the sun? And again, these curvilinear natural forms. He was very, very, very polite, very welcoming. I was just a young architecture student. I wasn't anybody. But he took time to talk with me. So,
wow.
Kind of, a great
That's experience. Amazing.
Master.
That's amazing. Well, I think your books and your work, your lectures, you can see the passion and all of your information. You have such rich information. I think this is from your experience with a lot of these architects. You've also met or you knew Jack Kilmer, Albert Frey. You knew Donald Wexler. Even. And I think that's why you have all of this knowledge, and thankfully you're sharing it with all of us. But for those of you that love Albert Frey that are listening, Alan, can you share with us what he was like, or what these, and Jack, what was Jack like?
Oh, yeah. both of them, strong individuals in their own right. Jack Kilmer, again, worked mostly in the San Francisco Bay Area. From Texas. And he was really, in his whole demeanor and lifestyle, a high priest of modernism. He was absolutely devoted to it. He treated architecture, modern architecture, almost like a religion. And it was sacred in terms of you had to do it right, and you had to be committed to it. And out of that sacred commitment came these absolutely extraordinary, innovative designs and homes, places to live, which were just so tied to their site, to nature and natural materials that you lived with every day. Not just an international style version of modernism, not just flat roofs and right angles, but more natural, more complex forms and everything. I mean, bringing in natural materials. I think one house, which was on Belvedere Island in San Francisco Bay, just above the beach area, but looking out towards Sausalito. Through many different layers, there was glass, but light came in through clear stories above, because there were several levels to the roof. And then there was this huge slab. I mean, it was the size of an SUV of Sierra Nevada granite. And he had gone up to Sierra Nevada to a quarry and hand-selected, had them cut this enormous block of natural stone, and then had it shipped. I mean, think of the effort that goes into all of this, but that's what he had to do because he was such a perfectionist. But on the inside, which it was part of the fireplace and an entire wall of itself, and that was the cut side, and it wasn't smoothly cut. It had been cut, and it was still kind of rough from cut there. But the back side of it, which was outside on a small courtyard, he had left it entirely natural. So it had the lichen, that had grown up over centuries, in the Sierra Nevada. So you have both of these sides, the man-made side, the cut side, and then the natural side. It was part of this house. I don't know. It's just one little detail of Jack. The thing about Jack was also that he was such a perfectionist. He did not care one whit for, architecture as a business. He wasn't trying to make a lot of money. But so as a result, he basically built one house every decade. But they were perfect.
Wow.
As a result, he was very well respected in the architecture community. Architects, it was an architect's architect. Architects understood what he was all about and admired him for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he would often ask me to write a book on him. And I dearly wanted to, but I had other projects. I never ended up doing a book on him, but I did write about him a couple of chapters in some of my books. I'd also mention Pierluigi Serrano, historian and architect as well. He has also written about Jack, but there's still much more. Jack is somebody who just the richness of his ideas would be such an inspiration for architects to learn from and understand today as well, to enrich architecture. So
right.
I can go on and on about
it. I love it. I love it. Well, that's what we're here to listen to. I remember sitting in Palm Springs at the Albert Frey House too. And just feeling that spirit, that sort of bohemian spirit, that wild energy. Was Albert very, did he have that boldness about him, or what was he like?
He was in some ways like Jack Kilmer, again, devoted to architecture, very different sorts of architecture. He was fairly modest as a person. He wasn't a big, you know, kind of outgoing personality, but he worked very hard and very well on his buildings. He was a bohemian. And again, so he didn't quite fit into the Palm Springs country club, nightclub sort of thing, which is what we think of.
Right.
Palm Springs modernism. And yet he was able to have a very successful, fruitful career for, you know, 50 or 60 years in Palm Springs. Unlike Jack Kilmer, he did figure out how to make money, keep himself going. Interestingly, part of that was designing ranch style houses or Smoke Tree Ranch,
which is
a very exclusive gated community in Palm Springs, been around since the 20s. And it's a marvelous place because they have kept the natural environment, the natural desert, natural plants, open space there because the desert is so beautiful. And they restricted the styles of the houses. They had to be the ranch style, shingle roof, one story, very, very simple in form. But Albert Frey became one of the favorite architects for people remodeling or building new there. So while he was also designing his own house that you mentioned, which is partway up the mountain and has a lot of glass and is a very simple house, but so exquisitely designed to every detail. He had this really wonderful, very diverse career. He did beautiful churches. He did gas stations. He did houses. Mm-hmm. He did liquor stores. He designed a miniature golf course, though that was never built. I would have loved to have seen that. So this is the interesting thing. I mean, we do think of architects often as, you know, huge egos, you know.
Right.
Frey was not that way at all. In fact, in the late 1930s, he was offered a job as a partner in a major New York architecture firm, which would have put him right at the center of the architectural world at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, he could have done high rises and, you know, college campuses, you know, all of that. But at that time, he had a choice. He had an architect partner in Palm Springs, John Porter Clark. And they had worked together a bit, but neither of them were licensed as architects. So they were kind of limited in what they could do. But just at this point, when he was offered the opportunity to be a partner in this hotshot New York firm, John Porter Clark called him up and said, "Hey, I just got my architecture license. We can start our own office."
Oh my gosh.
So here's his choice, you know? And what does he choose? He chooses to move to the middle of nowhere, which is what Palm Springs was. Nobody paid any attention to Palm Springs at that time, except if you were going on vacation. Mm-hmm. And he stayed there and had a very successful career. Wow. Interesting man, interesting choice. Kind of breaks some of the stereotypes that you might think about the architecture profession.
Yes. I've gotten to know a lot of architects over the years and with my work, and people always say, if you are an architect, you never retire. You never think about you. You are that devoted artisan. You are that devoted. Things have to flow through you for this work, and it's something you never give up. It's very pure.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. You also knew Donald Wexler. And speaking of Palm Springs, kind of royalty in architecture, can you share with us a little bit about him?
Don also was this very modest man, and did not put on airs, very warm, very human, has three sons as well who just, you know, adored him, and have helped to carry on his reputation, which is great. But again, there's this spark. Maybe we're finding some sort of a trend here between Hilmer and Frey and Wexler. He was devoted to modern architecture. And his inclination was engineering. He loved how things went together, whether it was, you know, wood post and beam structures, as in his own house, or very particularly the steel houses and schools that he designed. Now, you know, you have to be a real kind of engineer nerd to really get into the details of engineering steel in particular. But and Don did. But beyond that, he wasn't, well, I won't say just an engineer. He was also an architect. And so he also found the ways to find beauty in that steel construction method. And so beauty of simplicity, of proportion, of function. All of these are, of course, modern, you know, characteristics. But you look at his buildings and they are very simple, and yet they have they aren't dull. They have that artistic character, which is what makes them architecture. And one thing, several of these people, architects that I've known, Don is a good example. His career, I mean, he'd retired, you know, by the, you know, the 90s, the aughts. He wasn't doing that much in terms of architecture. And his career had been mostly, you know, 30, 40, 50 years before. And he had been working in Palm Springs and not getting that much attention. I mean, he did get, you know, attention for his steel houses, but his career was behind him at that point. And then suddenly in Palm Springs around 2000, 2010, when suddenly we discovered, hey, Palm Springs is this treasure trove of modern architecture. Suddenly he had a new career as a rock star.
Right.
Of modern architecture. And he would speak at Palm Springs Modernism Week every year. A book was written about him. An exhibit was put on at the Palm Springs Art Museum of his work. And this is the period when I got to know him. And it was so wonderful to see this guy who had just kind of been an ordinary architect, no particular attention for all those years, suddenly get the attention and see how much people loved his work and appreciated it and wanted to meet him. He was the guy who had done it. And again, you know, as I said, he was modest. He didn't let it go to his head or anything, but I know he appreciated it. That people appreciated his work. And that's wonderful. That's one of the most satisfying things about my own work, that I've been able to bring some attention to these people who deserve it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love how you're not only bringing attention to them, but you are working tirelessly for preservation of these homes, preservation of this architecture, commercial and residential. And so let's switch gears then to talk about preservation. You have been on the State Historic Resources Commission, and you are qualifying several buildings for the National Register of Historic Places. How do you, you've done many buildings, including the oldest McDonald's drive-in restaurant. You've been involved with these places. You've also, we're worried about the Sunset, the original Sunset building right now. How is this work going on? How do you qualify these properties for the National Register of Historic Places?
Every state has an office of historic resources, historic preservation office. And we have one, of course, in Sacramento. And the Historical Resources Commission kind of oversees their work. So when an individual submits a nomination, or an organization submits a nomination for a building or a site, I mean, this includes American Indian sites as well, Native American sites, and Victorian houses and Deco buildings and yes, modern, I mean, all the way up. Any kind of building that has some historical character, either the architecture is distinctive or something important happened there, somebody lived there, or some great historic event occurred there, a nomination can be submitted by any individual. And the staff of the Historic Preservation Office in Sacramento can help you understand what needs to go into it. So even if you aren't an expert historian or something, you can submit these. And then every quarter, the Historical Resources Commission reviews these and approves them. We send them on then to Washington, D.C., and the National Park Service, which oversees the National Register of Historic Places. And they review them and then finally put them on the register. But we are an important, you know, vetting part of the process to see that indeed all it is historic. We don't approve everything, but the process is one to make sure that a building is important. And again, we have a range of buildings. I mean, we have approved buildings by Richard Neutra. But on the other hand, we've also approved really simple concrete block veterans of foreign wars buildings in a city. I mean, architecturally, they're nothing. But this one happened to be the first Japanese-American VFW hall of that period of time. Yeah. So it has a significance to history and society and culture. So if you look at a building and it looks simple and ugly, it still could be historic.
Yes. I have a lot of clients. We just sold a Frank Lloyd Wright that was not on the National Register. It was not protected at all. And I think my advice to homeowners thinking of whether or not to do this, I would definitely do it. It sets the tone that this is significant architecture. This is very valuable. It's very important to preserve. And I think that it also teaches buyers, you know, what to do. A lot of people have their hands up. What do we do with this? When you have a home, a property, commercial or residential protected, it really sets the tone and provides more value, shows the buyers that it is rare and very special. So for those of you that have questions about that, you can email me. And also there's a lot of information that Alan has on his website. It's alanhess.net is his website too. So going back to preservation, you were talking about a building that you're working on right now that you're worried about. Can you share a little bit of that with us and the work that you're doing behind that?
Yes, it's a commercial building. It's a Googie-style building, a coffee shop on Van Nuys Boulevard in the San Fernando Valley. It was originally called Stanley Burke's from 1958. It was designed by Armé and Davis, the premier Googie-style architects. And it was later known as the Lamplighter, and it was also known as Corky's. And now it has been empty for 3 years and fenced in, and we've had problems with graffiti and break-ins, and there's nothing worse than a historic building that's empty because they tend to burn down. So we are now at the point where we're finally going to be starting reconstruction of the building to restore it to its 1958 design. One of the interesting things about the design in particular, they said Armé and Davis were the architects. Working with them was a woman named Helen Liu Fong, who was Asian American. And she designed most of the interiors of these coffee shops. The only problem with this is that in 1981, the entire interior was remodeled. So nothing remained of Helen's original design. But as we've been investigating this building, we're doing what we call forensic investigation, which is tearing off remodeled elements, tearing down acoustic tile ceiling that had been added, tearing off plasterboard walls to see what was underneath, tearing up tile and carpeting to find a terrazzo floor.
Oh, great. And
we discovered some of the most amazing things. Once we had taken out all these alterations, and for example, there was a clear story window on the north side of the building, which brought in northern light to this the dining space as well. Well, it had been hidden above a dropped acoustic tile ceiling for 40 years. We were so surprised when, you know, we realized it was still there, needed repair, but this is sort of detail that we are going to restore. And again, to tell the story of Helen Liu Fong, an Asian American woman born in Los Angeles, went to Berkeley in the early 1950s. Then came home to Los Angeles. Her family operated a cleaning establishment, and found her way with what turned out to be extraordinary talent to work for Armé and Davis for, I don't know, 30 some years. This is part of modernism's history, part of Los Angeles's history. It hasn't been told before. These minorities, African American, Asian American, whatever, has not been a big part of the story as we've been telling it. And yet there were these people like Helen Fong who were there and working and doing great, extraordinary.
Yes. Yes.
So that's the very satisfying thing about the Historic Resources Commission, to bring out these stories so that people can appreciate these people as well as what they did. So yes. I don't go on and on. Hopefully, at the end of 2024, this coffee shop, Stanley Burke's, will be back in more or less original shape. Right. We've made some alterations, but we're keeping the defining historic characteristics, including, I'm really happy about this, the neon sign. We are restoring the original neon
Great.
Sign.
Great. So. I'm laughing because most of my work for the last 15 years has been removing what other people have done to these houses. And it's just a never-ending process of bringing something back to what it was. And people really appreciate that. I think that what you're doing is so valuable and important, which brings me to your book, Forgotten Modern. And I wanted to talk about that. Not only is this visually beautiful, but the message is clear. Can you share with us a little bit about this book, Forgotten Modern, that you can also buy, everyone listening, you can also buy it on Amazon?
Yeah, again, this is kind of one of my missions in my career. Because as I've been going on, along, I'm an architect. I went to UCLA Architecture School, had some great professors who opened my eyes to a number of different architects and building types that I'd never known before, that were not widely known, but which were extraordinary. And so, I mean, you know, the big names, Richard Neutra, Rudolf Schindler, John Lautner, Frank Lloyd Wright, we do appreciate them, and their buildings are wonderful, of course. But there were all of these other architects who, interestingly, were not that interested in publicizing themselves or not that good at it.
Right.
And so they have been forgotten. And their buildings are out there, and they're beautiful buildings, but they tend to get torn down because nobody knows who Jack Kilmer is or Alan Seipel or some of these other architects that I did include in Forgotten Modern. So Forgotten Modern was to point out, you know, there are these other architects. We should be paying attention to them. They were very individual, had their individual creativity in their buildings, and often were just really wonderful houses, wonderful residences, wonderful places to live. And the way that they used light and materials and views and space. And there's just such a variety of those sorts of buildings out there, especially in California.
Yes.
I was born here. I love California. And there are many other great parts of the country, certainly. But in this post-World War II period, California boomed. The population, it became the most populous state in the nation in 1964. What does that mean? That means more people need houses. That means more people need shops and schools. And there's a demand for architecture simply because of the huge population. But also, California attracted, because of our weather, because of our creativity, attracted people like John Lautner and Schindler and Neutra and all these other talented, talented architects. And so you have all this building going on, you have a lot of talented architects, and as a result, you have a lot of really great architecture. Going back to the National Register, there are a lot less buildings on the National Register than you might imagine. Mm-hmm. So I really would encourage people to, you know, if they have their own house or a local library building or something that's really great, go ahead, try putting it on the National Register seeing, because we need to respect these buildings. The National Register doesn't really have that many restrictions on what you can do with a building if it is on the National Register.
Right.
That's kind of, you know, misunderstood. It's not like you can't ever change it or right. paint it or whatever. So there is that misunderstanding out there. But what it does do is put a spotlight so that people can, you can say, this is high level of architecture. This is the standard that we should be you know, reaching for in all of our buildings that we are doing today. That will, over time, you know, improve the entire nature of our cities. So it's one reason why I do love historic preservation.
Yes, you do love it. And I think you, I've learned so much from you. And for those of us that are learning and growing into this community, you have provided so much information for us to do that. And I think that you've set up so much of this valuable information for your posterity. So thank you so much for that. And in closing, we wanted to ask you, what is it you love most about this architecture and the reason behind all of your work over all these years doing this? What is it? Why do you love it so much?
Well, I'm as an architect, I was trained to understand space and materials and structure. So I just, you know, if I walk into it, and I still can walk into a building that I, you know, never been in before and just be, you know, blown away by the creativity, the ideas that the architect put into it. It's just exciting. It's, you know, like looking at a great painting or listening to great music of any sort. Architecture, the creation of space in the hands of a real master can be just as inspiring and insightful and stimulating as any great work of art. And isn't that something that, you know, we should all have in our daily lives, in our the buildings that we work in and go to school in or shop in? And that's the thing. In the mid 20th century, this period that I know you're interested in as well, there was just a remarkable number of good architects who were doing all of these buildings for the average person and lifting the level of livability, the quality of life in our cities. You know, that's something that we should strive for. We should never forget that. In my book, Googie Modern, one thing we did is we have these drawings of what these buildings look like originally. And then my co-author, Michael Murphy, went out to those sites and we had the address and photographed the site today from the same angle as the drawing had originally been drawn, except the building had been torn down. The building wasn't there. And there was some other commercial building there. And quite frankly, the level of quality between these Googie coffee shops in the mid-century to the, you know, the gas station or the U-Haul building or whatever, we've come down.
Right.
And we shouldn't let our cities, you know, decline in quality in that way. So.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for being on the show. I am a huge fan of yours and I love your books. I love your work. Thank you so much for your contribution to this community.
Good. Enjoy talking to you, Mindy. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. All right, everyone. We'll see you next episode. Thanks so much. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.